In this lecture, we will look at the Catholic model of decision-making, that is the deontological model, and contrast it with the dominant secular model. We'll also look at three important concepts in Catholic moral theology that are of great relevance, particularly in the study of bioethics. And those are the concept of natural law, what it means and what it doesn't mean, the principle of double effect, the recognition of the fact that every action has multiple and not merely one consequence, and then finally the notion of virtue and how that's understood, particularly in the Roman Catholic tradition. First, let's look at models of ethical decision-making. Number one, and if you drop down to the gray-blue bar marked 1A, the dominant secular model, it can hardly be denied that in modern society, the principal way that actions are judged is by their consequences, by their effect. There is great reluctance to admit the importance of the intention of the person who acts, and certainly even more reluctance to admit that there may be acts which are of themselves always wrong. There is particular emphasis on the consequences, hence the term consequentialism, or the outcome and whether or not it is useful or valuable to the individual or society. Now, intriguingly, this is not uniformly held, and there are certain rather almost schizophrenic elements within the modern model of consequentialism and utilitarianism, and that is that, for example, the intentions of the agent are on the one hand supposed to be not the proper study of or not be able to be judged by any outside authority, and yet on the other hand, in questions of jurisprudence, a given action may be a tragic accident or a premeditated murder, depending on the intention of the individual who commits the act. So, in fact, we do recognize the significance of intention, even though in our secular world there's a very strong tendency to regard acts as being valuable or morally good, based primarily or exclusively on the effect, on the consequence of that action. And so it would not be uncommon, certainly it's not uncommon in the media today, to find individuals justifying actions which would at one time, and certainly are still in Catholicism, regarded as morally evil, regarding them as either neutral or potentially beneficial because the act has what is regarded as a beneficial or a useful consequence or act. Now, if you drop down to 1B, this is, of course, not the approach that is taken in Catholic decision-making. I've emphasized the approach of deontology, which refers to the fact that actions have, in virtue of their nature, their ontological nature, their essence, qualities or characteristics. Actions are either by their nature morally wrong, evil, or neutral, or good. Actions are in themselves judged and judgeable. Now, the Catholic moral theological tradition does not simply look at the question of actions, but acknowledges quite rightly what modern psychology has emphasized, that engaging in an act will feed back into the agent, the person who acts. And that's why I have some arrows going back onto the man pondering what it is that he's going to do, the manufacturer of, in this case, a ring of power. The reflection on that action will be conditioned to some extent by actions that have been previously engaged in. The acts we perform habitually will have the effect of making it easier for us to engage in those actions in future. We create patterns of behavior by acting in certain ways, and these patterns of behavior are called habits. And their effect within us, our ability to judge effectively, as we'll see, is described as conscience, and conscience can be either strengthened by engaging in good actions, by reflecting on the nature of good actions, or it can be numbed, that is to say, it can be rendered less clear, it can be made foggy or fuzzy. One's conscience can be damaged by engaging in actions that are themselves wrong, but which set up patterns of bad behavior within the individual. So the action has its own value or effect. The intentions of the agent are very important. Neutral acts may in fact be be wrong or right depending upon the intention with which they're undertaken by the individual engaging in them. And of course, actions have consequences. But in Catholic moral theology, it's particularly emphasized that there is almost never an action with only one consequence. And so in this picture, you have the effect of creating the ring having multiple effects. The creation of the ring, number one, or it might break the anvil, or it might break the arm of the person striking the anvil, or sparks might fly away from the anvil and set a forest ablaze. So there are always multiple actions, and one has to take those actions into account, but as we'll see in the principle of double effect, there is a particular concern in Catholic moral theology to describe the principal effect and secondary effects, effects that flow from that principal effect, and then to emphasize that the agent is primarily responsible for that principal effect. So, as I've highlighted in the paragraphs that follow, Catholic moral theology considers both the intention of the agent and the effects of the action, and considers acts to have intrinsic moral significance in themselves. In 1C, I've also highlighted another factor which is characteristic of our Catholic tradition and not of modern society, and that is that we are convinced that we are intended to live forever with God, in union with God and with one another in heaven. That is, we have an eternal goal and destiny. God has a goal in store for all of us, and an awareness of that goal, a sense that actions either contribute towards it or make that goal more difficult, acts either contribute to our salvation or impede our movement towards God, that in itself is of significance in guiding our actions, as we'll see, and this is important in the concept of natural law that follows. But again, in Catholic moral theology, there will be a strong emphasis on our final end, our telos, our goal, that is our goal of eternal life in union with God, a goal which secular consequentialist ethics does not acknowledge and refuses to admit even exists. So let's turn then to the next area, and that is our understanding of natural law. Natural law is grossly misunderstood in our culture. The term is sometimes used in the legal profession in a way different from how Catholics understand it. Catholics understand natural law to mean the awareness within ourselves, in virtue of the fact that God has created us, the awareness of the ability to respond to God's eternal law. We have within us an awareness of what is right or wrong, which is given to us as a gift by God, and which can either be strengthened and clarified and rendered more accurate by our attending to God's revelation and by engaging in actions that are in conformity with God's will, or that awareness of right or wrong can be weakened by engaging in acts that are sinful and trying to convince ourselves that such acts are not sinful. Natural law has to do with our inner awareness of, our inner capacity to appreciate the eternal law of God, God's will for us as creator, which is based on God's understanding of and God's desire for us to live out our full potential as human beings. That potential is something which God, of course, only God knows. So these selections that I've chosen are from Veritatis Splendor, the encyclical of John Paul II on moral theology, in which he particularly emphasizes the traditional understanding of natural law, which we'll look at here, although rather briefly, because I presume that you've studied this in other courses. In number 39, there's an emphasis on the fact that we have the capacity to perform morally good acts, which will strengthen, develop, and consolidate within ourselves our likeness to God. Engaging in virtuous action makes us more human, makes us more what God wants us to be, makes us more like God, makes us more the human beings God intends to live in eternal union with Himself. So engaging in moral actions is not simply a matter of virtue, although it creates virtue, as we'll see, but it also makes us more like God Himself. Then in number 40, we begin to have a series of statements that are drawn from primarily from the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas, and then reiterated by later popes. Here we see in number 40 the emphasis on reason. Our reason is in fact a reflection of the eternal reason or will of God. Reason draws its truth and authority from the eternal law, which is to say, from God, which is none other than the divine wisdom itself. So the fact that we are capable of reason, of engaging in intellectual reflection and with an awareness of what is right and wrong, is because we have within us a gift that God has given us, a capacity to see, to understand, and to respond to God's divine wisdom, to God's eternal law. At the same time, we have a rightful autonomy. That is, our reason makes decisions based on our own unique circumstances. And our circumstances are varied and specific, and so we have to engage in this proper autonomy, this ability to make decisions in a particular context, but it does not mean that we are independent in determining what is right and wrong. Our actions, which are based on our unique circumstances, have their origin, as St. Thomas says, in God and our source in God. So he then goes on to say, and I've highlighted this text particularly in white, the natural law is nothing other than the light of understanding infused in us by God. So natural law is intimately related to our capacity for reason, but our moral reasoning informed by the divine will. Our interior understanding of what is given to us by God, Thomas says, infused in us by God, whereby we understand what must be done and what must be avoided. God gave this light and this law to us as human beings at creation. Then the Pope emphasizes in the following paragraph the fact that there is this autonomy of reason. There are the unique circumstances and the need for individual choice, but it does not mean that our individual reason creates values or determines moral norms, which is exactly what many schools of modern moral philosophy claim. We as Catholics do not believe that reason creates values or norms, but can perceive the values and norms that are reflections of God's eternal law. If we drop down, what follows in number 42 is a kind of a meditation on this text from the first psalm, "Blessed is the man who takes delight in the law of the Lord." And then in number 42, the Pope emphasizes that dignity requires us to act through conscious and free choice, and that dignity takes place, that freedom happens, when we free ourselves from subservience to our feelings. That is, paradoxically, our own feelings may bind us, and it's only when we free us from our unique individual conviction that we know what's right independently of God and recognize that God alone is good, as in the next paragraph, and that our true freedom will consist in acting in accordance with that will. Then we move on to more citations from St. Thomas in the section that follows that has a little gold bar above it that begins after saying, "Offer right sacrifices." And then highlighted in white, I've emphasized this citation, "The light of natural reason, whereby we discern good from evil, which is the function of natural law, is nothing else but an imprint on us of the divine light." So God's divine light is God's eternal law that, as it were, shines upon us, and our natural reason, our discernment of good from evil, is the function of natural law. So when we say natural law, we do not mean looking out at the world, perceiving what happens in nature, or perhaps in human societies, or perhaps in other species, and calling that natural or natural law. Natural law in Catholic theology has to do with something uniquely specific to human beings created in God's image, given the ability to perceive good and evil, because as human beings, that image of God enables them to partake in, to perceive something of the light of God's eternal law. And this is emphasized in that other section that I've highlighted here in white. It is called natural law not because it refers to the nature of irrational beings, that is to say, to what happens in what, say, science or popular culture would call nature. Natural law is not what happens in what the world means by nature, but we call it or use the term natural law because it is the reason that promulgates it is proper to human nature. So natural law is something uniquely human in the sense that it is our gift from God and a reflection of our nature as having a participation and a partaking in the divine nature. Then going on to number 43, under the gentle guidance of God's providence, we learn to recognize the unchanging truth. So this capacity for recognizing in the voice of our conscience natural law, that is the reflection within us of God's eternal law, grows and develops as we engage in activities and in choices that are in conformity with God's law. If we drop down a little further to just above number 44, natural law is an expression of God's eternal law. And here's another quotation from St. Thomas, which reinforces what we've just said. Among all others, the rational creature is subject to divine providence in the most excellent way, in that it partakes of a share of providence. It has a share of the eternal reason, and this participation of the eternal law in the reasoning creature is called natural law. So for St. Thomas, natural law is a participation in the eternal law by the reasoning creature. So we'll drop down to number 44. Again, a statement that natural law is written on our hearts. It is, and here's a statement from Leo XIII, it is in some ways none other than human reason itself. So there's an intimate connection between what we understand the notion of natural law to be and our possession of reason as human beings. Dropping down again, another highlighted area, it follows that natural law is the eternal law implanted in beings endowed with reason, inclining them towards right action and their end. And this is a citation from Leo XIII, and we are able to recognize good and evil by reason, enlightened by divine revelation and by faith. So we don't believe that reason or natural law are autonomous. They are strengthened and enabled to become more what they should be insofar as we listen to and are eager to learn from what God reveals and also to deepen in our own faith in God. So growth in our relationship with God enables our ability to perceive natural law, enables to become deeper, enables our consciences to become more clear, enables us ultimately to be more free. And if we drop down now to the next section on this page, number 3, the principle of double effect. I'm sure you've studied this in other courses. There's an example of this in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, numbers 2263 and 2264, where again, it is St. Thomas that provides us with the background. The action of self-defense can have a double effect, preservation of one's own life and the killing of the aggressor. And so St. Thomas would say that when one kills an aggressor, one's intention is to preserve one's own life, and hopefully not the primary intention is to kill the other individual. So the action of protecting oneself may have the unintended effect of killing another, but may be therefore permissible because, according to the principle of double effect, as we'll see, there are conditions attached to this. One is responsible primarily for the immediate effect. The one is intended, the other is not. So intention is very important in the principle of double effect. If we drop down to the red section in red with a little gold bar above it, there are certain conditions that are required for the principle of double effect to be invoked. We are primarily responsible for the primary effect of an action, not for its unintended, and this is the key, secondary effects. One can't employ double effect if you really secretly, but don't want to admit it, want the secondary effect. And you engage in the primary effect and say, oh my goodness, that wasn't what I intended to do, but in fact, it is what you intended. Your intention has to be the good effect or the neutral effect, and you have to not want or not intend the secondary effect, the secondary bad effect. So the conditions are listed with red headings. Number one, the act itself that you engage in must be either morally good or neutral. Double effect does not mean that you can engage in an act that is intrinsically evil and claim that somehow it's acceptable because there are going to be multiple effects and you only intend the good one. The act, in order for the principle of double effect to be invoked, must be either good or neutral. The agent may not will the bad effect. So if you're using the principle of double effect to say, I'm engaging in this action and it's going to have this as a primary effect, I don't intend for it to have a secondary effect, and if I could avoid that secondary effect, I would. The good effect must flow from the first action immediately. That is to say, it cannot be the result of the bad effect. And again, we have to emphasize the bad effect must not be intended. And number four, the good effect must be sufficiently desirable to compensate for permitting the bad effect. So there does have to be a weighing of all the circumstances involved in the action. So your double effect cannot be invoked to excuse a secondary effect with catastrophic or devastating consequences that could be foreseen. The action that one would claim to be the good action may not compensate for those effects, and therefore the principle couldn't really legitimately be applied. But again, this is an important principle in Catholic moral theology because every action does have multiple consequences, and one needs to be clear on what one's primary moral responsibility is for, and that is for the initial or principal effect of a given action. Finally, I want to emphasize in number four here that virtue, as it is classically understood in the pre-Christian tradition of Aristotle, and then again in its revival with St. Thomas Aquinas, virtue is not simply something opposed to a vice or to a bad action. Virtue is not just a good action opposed to a bad one. Virtue is balance. Virtue is a midpoint or a mean. And so for every, let's call them, human energy, there is both a vice of excess and a vice of deficiency, and the virtue consists in maintaining a balance between those. So, for example, and this is straight out of the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, and it's reiterated in St. Thomas Aquinas' treatise on the virtue, in regard to something like fear or confidence, if the virtue you want to achieve is courage, then there is an vice of excess called rashness, jumping out and doing things, even things that are destructive, which is to be avoided, and there is also the vice of cowardice, a deficiency of courage, where you don't act at all. In regard to pleasure or pain, or the category of desire, if the virtue is temperance, to be able to recognize that one is to use one's capacity for desire in a good and effective way, one has to avoid the excess of self-indulgence, engaging in the act simply because it's pleasurable. But there's also a device of deficiency, insensibility, sometimes called anesthesia, the notion that that it is good to not feel at all, to have no desire whatever. That is not achieving the virtue of temperance. That is simply attempting to amputate one's energy for desire. And so, again, in all human capacities, the real understanding of virtue will be that it is an attempt to maintain a virtuous midpoint between excess and deficiency. Now, if you drop down to the last thing on our little page, virtue as spiritual warfare, because in general, although it's true that virtue is a midpoint, in fact, in the area of most human energies, whether it has to do with desire or with courage, there is a strong tendency towards either deficiency or excess. And one can kind of, as it were, ignore the less common vice and emphasize the one that is most prevalent. That's what's classically or often been done in Christian spiritual theology. There's a tendency sometimes to contrast virtue with vice and to claim that prudence is opposed to ignorance, that temperance is opposed to lust, courage against cowardice, justice against injustice, and so forth. Whereas in reality, in human experience, the truth is much more complex. Yes, generally speaking, it's not the absence of desire, in the case of lust, sexual desire, that one usually has to combat, but it's excessive presence, and so temperance usually consists of not acting on one's desires. But remember that St. Thomas, in his appropriation of Aristotle, and the best of the Catholic moral theological tradition, would always say, but don't forget that there is also a vice of the opposite kind, and that real virtue consists in maintaining this balance, to engage one's energies and one's capacities in a way that avoids the temptation to a vice of excess on the one hand and a vice of deficiency on the other.